the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. President Trump says local governments need to dominate the streets. If they can't, he threatened to deploy the U.S. military. Now, to do that, he'd have to invoke a law signed by President Thomas Jefferson over 200 years ago. The last time it was used, right here in L.A. in 1992. We'll hear what happened then and how it could look very different if it's used today. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up on the show, we'll discuss the history of the LAPD and the black community and how it all relates to the events of the last several days. Plus, what the Hollywood studios are asking for as Los Angeles reopens. We start today, though, on the streets. That's the sound at Manhattan Beach Pier earlier this afternoon. Now, generally, it's been a lot calmer around Los Angeles. Yes, there were reports of looting in some neighborhoods last night, but peaceful protests occurred. And today, so far, that continues. Still, in a stunning address in the Rose Garden on Monday, President Trump said he told various governors to, quote, dominate the unrest. And then he added that if they didn't, he would take over the effort using the U.S. military.
Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
For the president to use these powers, it would take invoking a law called the Insurrection Act. It's rarely used, but the last time it was right on our very own streets here in Los Angeles back in 1992. So to give us an explainer on the law and what we know about how it was used in the past, we have Stephen Vladek. He's a professor of law at the University of Texas in Austin, where he specializes in military justice and national security. Stephen, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first, to give us a basic overview of what the Insurrection Act is meant to be used for generally at its core.
Well, I think it's meant to be used for a couple different things. I mean, these statutes trace all the way back to the earliest years of the country in 1792. And the idea was to provide basically a fallback, a reserve of personnel who the president could call upon in situations in which local law enforcement, state authorities were either unable or unwilling to ensure that state and federal laws were being enforced.
So the Insurrection Act goes almost back to the American Revolution?
It does. You know, one of the real critical events that helped to catalyze the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was an uprising in Western Massachusetts called Shays' Rebellion that the federal government at the time was impotent to respond to. And so, you know, giving the new federal government under the Constitution the power to effectively and adequately respond to domestic crises with military force was actually a pretty important goal for the founders. They did that by giving the power to Congress to delineate the circumstances in which such force could be called out by the president. And Congress, 3 years into its existence under the Constitution, put that power into effect.
Now, I mentioned that it was last used in 1992 right here in Los Angeles. And at the time, there was the civil unrest because of the verdict in the Rodney King case. Then Governor Pete Wilson was the one who asked that it be used to give him help. Can you tell us about how using the law and the military played out during that time?
That was an example, of really the cooperative model of the Insurrection Act, where basically the state and the federal government working together decided that federal troops would be necessary to help restore order. As you say, you know, Governor Wilson requested that President George H.W. Bush call out the military. President Bush agreed. And, you know, I think there was some alarm bells were rung about having troops on the ground in Los Angeles, but I also think that, you know, the presence of the military, for better or for worse, did help to stabilize things, calm things down, and eventually, you know, to the restoration of order.
Stephen, in hindsight, what's the assessment of what using the military did in that particular situation, 1992 in LA?
I mean, I think the hindsight is that the military was sort of the extra manpower and the depoliticized manpower. I mean, part of the issue in 92A, and I think part of what we're seeing today, is that some of these protests are anti-police protests. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that the very people you're protesting are going to be the ones to, you know, calm things down and restore order is hard for a lot of these folks to swallow. You know, the military, for better or for worse, its primary function is not policing. There are reasons why we don't want it to be principled. ostensibly a police force, but the military, at least in 92, I think brought with it some modicum of independence and neutrality, that it wasn't the LA police, that it wasn't responsible for the abuses that was animating so much of the passions at the time.
We're talking about President Trump possibly invoking the Insurrection Act, and we're talking about it with Stephen Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas in Austin. So, all right, turning to what the president said yesterday, there are several details that were left unclear. First, he would say he would use the military, but there are many parts to the armed forces. So I'm wondering, Stephen, which military division could he use? All of them or just maybe a few?
The president, of course, could start, if he wanted to, by federalizing different state guard units, whether in California and other states. He has the authority to do that. That doesn't require invoking the Insurrection Act. He also then could resort to calling out regular army troops, military police battalions, infantry units. I mean, I think in 92A, we saw the president, President Bush, actually call out a bunch of infantry units to help just provide manpower on the ground.
Wondering if geography plays a role there. I know 29 Palms, that's a Marine Corps ground combat center. That's where they train. That's right down the road from us here in Los Angeles. Camp Pendleton is just the south. Would the Marines maybe be the ones to get that first call because they're generally closer to LA?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you know, the military is nothing if not prepared. And so there are contingency plans for which units would go where in response to which kinds of crises. You know, will the president stick to those plans if we get that far? Your bet's as good as mine. But I do think, you know, the key to me, and I think this is a point that gets lost in a lot of these conversations, a lot of folks hear the military being called out and think, oh my gosh, the president's imposing martial law. Martial law is a situation where the military basically takes over, where there's no functioning civilian authority, and where the military is there simply because someone has to be. That's not what we're talking about here, right? I mean, in 92, and I think even today, what we're talking about is using the military to supplement the local and state authorities on the ground.
So let me get this straight, Stephen. If the president invokes this law over the wishes of local leaders, does that mean that the military supersedes local law enforcement over coordinating efforts? Or are local police officers and sheriff's departments still in charge?
A lot of that's going to be up to the commanders on the ground. I mean, the military's principal function in this context is to back up law enforcement, man intersections, is to, you know, show the flag, right? Just, you know, be out in force to try to deter looting and rioting and other unlawful behavior. In theory, there's supposed to be unified command through civilian leaders that the president's supposed to coordinate with local officials on the ground. You know, one could imagine, I suspect, a hypothetical where there's real disagreement about how the forces should be used. We've been pretty lucky throughout, you know, modern uses of the Insurrection Act, that hasn't happened, that there's actually been a really high degree of pretty sophisticated coordination and cooperation between state and federal authorities. Again, because I think they're always, at least in the historical examples, swimming in the same direction. And that was true in 92 in the Rodney King riots. They have the same goal of restoring order. If we get to a point where the goals diverge, you know, I think you could have real awkwardness. I mean, it was the Insurrection Act that President Eisenhower used to send the army into Little Rock to enforce judicial desegregation orders. So, you know, there is also authority for the president, less popularly, to send in the military even over the objections of local and state authorities.
Here, California's Governor Gavin Newsom did not directly address or respond to what the president said, but Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker reportedly said, quote, well, it's illegal. He can't do it. Stephen, is he right?
No. I mean, I'm a big fan of Governor Pritzker's. I think that the tricky part here is that there are good reasons, why federal law gives the president the ability in some circumstances to use the military for domestic law enforcement, even when local and state authorities don't want him to. The devil's in the details. And the question is whether the circumstances that Congress has set forth are actually present. I don't think it's obvious, that they are, but I also don't think it's obvious that they aren't. And especially as, you know, the situation continues to unfold on the ground in Los Angeles, in New York, in all these other major American cities, I think it's going to be a shifting situation where, you know, the case for using the military may be stronger in some parts of the country and weaker in others.
Stephen Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas in Austin, where he specializes in military justice and national security. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So they have a saying in the news biz, report the story, don't become it. And yet, during this difficult year, it's hard to find a person whose life hasn't been affected in some way by the news, including the unrest that we've seen over the past week. Take Two producer Austin Cross has been behind almost all of our conversations about the issues facing Black communities. But as he explained on our website, Elliest, it can be hard to separate yourself from some stories when the ones getting hurt look like you. Here's Austin telling his story, and a warning: there is strong language used that some may find offensive.
I didn't realize I was Black until I was 11. I was a mixed kid. I grew up in Westwood. My dad wore a suit and tie every day. He worked as a volunteer mediator with the Los Angeles City Attorney's Office. And that put us in contact with law enforcement and city officials on the highest level. Mayor Richard Reardon once taught me how to shake hands. When I bashfully told him that I hoped to run for president in 2024, he told me I had his vote. When Los Angeles housing costs threatened my father's dream of keeping his family in the safest neighborhood possible, we moved to the Inland Empire. I was in fifth grade. The culture shock was palpable. I hadn't even lived there a year when a classmate felt compelled to inform me that I don't act Black. And then came what I now sardonically refer to as my cannot unsee period. My dad asked our neighbor's daughter to stop playing in our driveway. I vividly remember what happened next. Her mother told her, matter-of-factly, that she didn't need to listen to my father. "We have more rights than them," she said as we listened. My world changed. In public spaces, I became hyper-aware of my Blackness. Still, I thought I could assimilate. I bought into Rancho Cucamonga-style conservatism. It's a spoken and unspoken doctrine that sifted my people into two groups, Black people and niggers. Yeah, that's verbatim, hard R. People told me that I was in the first group, that I was, quote, not like the others. I'm ashamed to admit it, but adolescent me started to believe it. The coming years would erode that notion. By my early 20s, all of my close friends who looked like me had experienced racism with law enforcement. At least three have looked down the barrel of a gun. I accepted these terrifying moments as a pseudo rite of passage. My test came in the late thousands in Corvallis, Oregon, a small town that I found oddly like Andy Griffith's Mayberry. The fly in the milk glass vibes were strong. I was 21. I had rented bikes while visiting an ex and returned them to the shop. Within minutes of leaving, I noticed several police cars slowly patrolling the city's quaint streets. Hoping to make myself appear to be less of a threat, I smiled at the officers in a passing patrol car. I even gave myself a pep talk. "They're not here for you." After a few tense moments, I sensed a squad car pulling up behind me. "Hey, big guy." "Damn it." "Excuse me, sir?" "Okay, fine." "Oh, hello, officer," I said, my voice instinctually raised a few octaves to mask my disappointment. We got word that someone saw you taking some bikes and rattling car doors," the officer said. In reality, I had removed bikes from the back of a truck and checked the lock. Clearly, I should have known better than to, you know, live life. I kept my receipt and showed it to the officer. That cleared things up quickly. What would have happened if I didn't have that receipt? I often wonder how the situation might have gone. George Floyd ended up dead over a report that he tried to pass a fake $20 bill. I'd hate to know what could happen over a few cheap bikes. The Corvallis encounter confirmed to me that I was not exempt from the plight of my people because I wore collared shirts and spoke well. The last vestiges of that belief were shattered that day. For so long, I wanted, needed, to think that there was something I could do to be safe in the world. There wasn't. There never was, really. I came to KPCC's Take Two show by way of CBS Radio in 2015. I took the lead on segments about race and policing. I'd bring on community organizers, tactical experts, historians, faith leaders, heck, even Martin Luther King Jr.'s speechwriter. I felt that I was living my purpose and bringing healing to the land. I covered unarmed killings. Etched in my mind are names like Walter Scott, Sandra Bland, and Philando Castile. After each incident, I diligently worked with a sense of purpose. Then came George Floyd. I think it broke me. There's so much work to be done, so many conversations to facilitate, and yet, in my heart, I feel what can only be described as hopelessness. Despair might be a close second. anguish a third. There's so much to be done, and yet I feel like I have little left in me. I actually think I believed I could change the world by amplifying the truth. Today, I realize now that my fight for justice and reconciliation, perhaps much like your fight, is but a small battle in a larger war over America's narrative. Victories are far and few. Progress is difficult to measure. And yet, I know that it is only by embracing the truth of how our society was designed that we will ever have the clarity to remake it. Widespread public angst isn't a quirk of the system. It's a result. God, it's so hard to tell your story, America. But I'll keep at it. My determined colleagues will keep at it. At a time when powers, both foreign and domestic, attempt to co-opt the narrative of this day, we will continue to polish the mirror and hold it to your face. Greek proverb teaches us that a society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in. And so today, I sit back down and do the most that anybody can do during this time. Try to create something that heals the world. Even if true change is something that I may never see.
That's Take Two producer Austin Cross, and you can read his essay on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. The history of civil unrest in Los Angeles goes back a ways. Watts, 1965, South LA, 1992, and then what we've seen and heard going back to last week. Now, while the names and faces of the protesters have changed over these eras, the one group that's been there for all three is the LAPD. We'll hear how their history of POC policing informs what's happening now. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The issue of how police treat people of color, and in particular black people, is at the core of the protests that have broken out across the country. They were, of course, triggered by the death of George Floyd, who died after a Minneapolis police officer handcuffed and restrained him by his neck. In Los Angeles, the relationship between the LAPD and black and brown Angelenos has its own painful history. Joining us now to discuss this is UCLA history professor Brenda Stevenson. Brenda, thanks so much for coming back on Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, Loyola Marymount University released a study today showing a low level of trust in police among LA's African-American community. And it was conducted before the death of George Floyd. And it found this, quote, while 62% of total respondents said they trust the police to do what is right, only 36% of African-Americans said the same. Brenda, what do you make of that number?
Well, I think it's probably an overestimation for African Americans, because African Americans have a long, long history of distrust with the policing. And it's not just the LAPD. Of course, there's a conflation of all kinds of policing agencies. And so African Americans need the police. We all need the police to do their jobs, and we appreciate them when they do them well. But African Americans disproportionately have been ill-treated by the police, and African Americans are aware of that.
Now, let's talk about that history of mistrust. When the police department was getting started here in Los Angeles, where did the early police officers come from?
Well, the early police officers, like many people from Southern California, actually migrated from the Deep South. And they were part of these waves of migration that came from the Deep South to Los Angeles, from Texas, Louisiana, in particular, those kinds of places, but also Alabama, Mississippi, et cetera. And so they brought with them these notions of racial difference. And inferiority of Black people, and these notions of Black people as being naturally criminal.
Brenda, in what ways was the practice of redlining and restrictions on where African Americans could live and work in the city, how did that play a role in how they were treated by police?
Well, redlining and segregation in general located African-Americans in a particular area. And in so doing, then the surveillance by the police in that area also was very much extended and was deepened. And so African-Americans, we were found in one area. Those areas could be heavily policed, over-policed. And the result was that African-Americans were overly criminalized. More arrests, more stops. More frisk, more invasion, you know, coming into the home and searching there, watching people on the street, those kinds of things. So placing African Americans in one or two locations made it easier for them then to become really victims of over-surveillance and over-policing.
And I hate to use this word, Brenda, but it almost feels like they were corralled into certain areas.
Well, often that's what segregation feels like. You know, I come from the segregated South, and coming to Los Angeles in the 90s, we were not still segregated, but I do recall not being able to look in certain neighborhoods for housing, real estate agents standing there and saying, go back. This actually happened to my husband and I when we first moved to Los Angeles in 1991.
We're talking to UCLA history professor Brenda Stevenson. Brenda, in the collective memory of the Black community in L.A., what have been the key moments in the history of the LAPD as it relates to African Americans?
Well, I think the key moments have, a lot of them have to do with the chokehold, for example, that could not be used in the 1980s. But prior to that time, the vast majority of the people who found themselves in the chokehold and who died from the chokehold were African American. I think, of course, the Watts riots from 1965 and, you know, the Rodney King event in 1991 and the L.A. riots and rebellion and insurrection in 1992. Also last year, almost a year ago, and it's not the LAPD, it's the Sheriff's Department. Again, these policing forces are often conflated in the public imagination. The death of Ryan Twyman, who the young man who was sitting in his car and they shot in the car 34 times. And he, of course, died from that. Now, no weapons in the car or anything like that. So these are the kinds of things that people think about. But I think also sometimes people think, on the other side, you know, police who have helped them. People see police taking a knee, for example, in the protest today, walking along with protesters. Those are positive moments. But unfortunately, there are many more fatal, deadly, grossly inappropriate moments that people bring to mind. And the thing is, it's not just what happens in LAPD. Everyone has a family that's national, some people global. And so, you know, the policing that comes to mind is in this broad context of what happened, you know, in Missouri and what happened in, you know, Oakland and what happened in South Carolina or Kentucky, et cetera. It all comes together with one's own experiences or experiences that someone knows or cares about to give this very dark sense of the relationship between people of color and LAPD.
And the trust, right? Because that's part of it. For an effective police force, you have to have the trust of the people that you are there policing, right? And if that trust isn't there, then it's tough to have that relationship.
Absolutely. If the trust is not there, people will not call the police when they absolutely need the police. I think that's one of the most tragic things. Oftentimes, African Americans and people of color actually need the police to come in and help them with the situation, but they will not do it because they're afraid that the outcome of calling for the police will be greater damage than if they had not called.
Let's talk about unconscious bias and how it is pervasive in our culture. And just last night, LAPD Chief Michael Moore said this when talking about looters in the city.
We have people mourning the death of this man, George Floyd. We had people capitalizing. His death is on their hands as much as it is those officers.
Now, he did apologize for these remarks a little later. And I guess, Brenda, maybe, you know, we could chalk it up to a guy being tired. We're all tired. We're all just kind of on edge. But he is a city official addressing this city during a very difficult time. Brenda, what did you make of that comment? And how do you see it in the context of the LAPD's history as it relates to African Americans?
Well, I see it. It's an unfortunate statement. I mean, this is something that's unfortunate. It's not true. And also, we now know that a lot of the people who are actually doing looting, who are actually causing fires and things like that, are people who are not part of the protest movement, but are people who are trying to undermine the protest movement. So I want to be really clear about that. I think there's a lot of evidence of that. But secondly, I'd like to say that he is not saying anything different from what we've heard nationally. Some of our national leadership also has spoken in this way. And so the LAPD does not operate in a vacuum. It is not unusual. It is not worse than or better than. This is a national notion. It's in the public imagination that Black people are criminals, that Black people are, you know, are lazy and want to take advantage of anything that's free, etc. And so this is something which, you know, it's been popularized and it's just part of American culture in a way. These notions of Black people doing the wrong thing. And so I think it's an unfortunate statement. I certainly wish he hadn't made it, but it's not something different than what you're going to hear other places.
I grew up in Los Angeles, born and raised here. And I think with all apologies to the rest of the country, that's something that I would, you know, wouldn't be surprised to hear somewhere else. But in L.A., of all places, that's where it cuts deeper than maybe most other things.
Well, you know, often people say this to me, and I grew up, as they said, in the segregated South. Yeah. So I grew up, you know, not finding that to be an unusual statement. Yeah. And I taught at the University of Texas at Austin before I came here. So I lived in Texas for a while. And then I came to Los Angeles and I was expecting this wonderful, magnificent city, and it is. But I found as much bias against African Americans here as I found any other place in the country and more than many places in the world. I just think it's part of the narrative of our nation that African Americans are distinct in a certain kind of way, and that people in Los Angeles feel this as much as people elsewhere in the country.
And you know, Brenda, when you put it in those terms, yeah, you're right. It's shocking. But then I thought about it for a second. It's probably even more than shocking. It's frustrating, right? For someone, as you mentioned, you grew up, you know, around the country. You lived around the country. I've lived here only my whole life. So I think I get the frustration in that I kind of see this place as a different place than anywhere else in the country. And then to hear it, it makes me think, well, maybe we're not so different. Maybe we're not so special.
Well, we're all American.
Right, right.
And that means that we've grown up in the history and the culture of America, the good part of it and the bad part of it. And racism is a bad part of it. And it is just as American as, you know, our ideals for democracy and freedom of speech and all of that. And when we know that and we can agree to that, then we can start working on that as a problem.
Now, when trying to talk about how police target and aggressively treat people of color, we often hear the term bad apples, the bad apples excuse. Now, here's a Trump National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien talking with Jake Tapper on CNN.
There are some bad cops that are racist, and there are cops that are, you know, maybe don't have the right training, and there's some that are just bad cops, and they need to be rooted out because there's a few bad apples that are giving law enforcement a terrible name, and there's no doubt that there's some racist police. I think they're the minority. I think they're the few bad apples, and we need to root them out.
So, Brenda, considering everything we've talked about, going back to the history of the LAPD when it comes to African Americans in this area, and hearing that term "bad apples," what does the African American community hear when leaders acknowledge there's racism, but that it's only in the mind or maybe in the hands of a few bad apples?
you know, the bad apple acts within a system of racism. And they can act that way and get away with it because there is a, you know, racism is systemic within this institution and within many institutions in the United States. And that's why this happens over and over and over again. Will most policemen go out and choke a black person to death? No. But when it happens, there are three policemen who sit around and watch it and do nothing about it. And they don't get charged along with the person who gets the least charge he could possibly have for this murder. And so this is what African-Americans see. So African-Americans don't want to hear about bad apples. They want to hear about a racist system that needs to be deeply changed.
That's UCLA history professor Brenda Stevenson. Brenda, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's been a very challenging few days, but we'd like to hear from you about who out there gives you hope that change could be on the horizon. As protests against police brutality are carried out across the region and the country, who are the leaders and the helpers who give you hope and help you keep the faith? Please, please let us know. You can find a link to share your submission on Twitter. You can find us at Take Two. That's at Take Two. Now, while you're there, we'd love for you to consider supporting KPCC. We're all going through a very, very tough time, and particularly us here at KPCC in the news biz. We're still covering the news, the pandemic, the protests, and everything happening as a result, but we need your support to keep that going, to keep you informed on what's happening with your neighbors and your neighborhood. Please consider going to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org, and give whatever you can, whatever you can swing right now. We're still out here giving you the news. One of our reporters, Adolfo Guzman Lopez, took a rubber bullet on Sunday covering things in Long Beach for all of us. So please, please consider sharing some of what you have with us. We would really appreciate it. All right, coming up with everything going on in LA, the pandemic has kind of taken a bit of a back seat. Still around, though, threatening lives, causing concern. We'll hear the story of two people who not only have that to fear, but also a decision that could radically change where they live. That's next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. Abby Martinez. With all that's been going on in the last few days, it's sometimes hard to remember that we are in a pandemic. There are almost 60,000 cases of COVID-19 in LA County, and as of yesterday, there were 978 new cases. More than 2,300 people have died. Yeah, the coronavirus is still a thing. And in one of his recent columns for LAS.com, KPCC's Eric Galindo talks to people who are on the front lines of it. His column is called Mis Angeles. And in this edition, he speaks with two DACA holders who fear not only the coronavirus, but also a potential Supreme Court decision that could reverse their legal status.
Like most essential workers, Mary Kate Mejia has a routine that helps bridge the massive anxiety gap that forms between getting off work and getting home to her family. Before she gets in her car, Mary Kate sprays herself down with disinfectant. As soon as she gets home, she puts all her work clothes in a plastic bag. Then she heads straight to the shower. And after all that, Mary Kate gives herself some time to mentally deal with two things that crush her soul even more than the fear of catching the coronavirus. That grocery store workers like her don't get the respect they deserve as frontline workers, and that as a DACA holder, her temporary legal status in the only country she's ever known may come to an abrupt end anytime now. I'm not saying they look down on you, but it feels like that, Mary Kate told me recently, both for being DACA and for being service workers. The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on whether the Trump administration can end DACA, an Obama-era executive order that gave a temporary legal status to people like Mary Kate who were brought to the U.S. as children without one. DACA has always been nebulous. It was meant as a stopgap measure until a path towards citizenship could be agreed upon by congressional leaders. But in the almost decade since it began, Mary Kate built a whole life. She has friends, she has a family, a place to live, and about half a decade of seniority at a union gig. Now that life is being threatened, not just by a deadly respiratory disease, but by unfavorable legal precedent. I spoke to Mary Kate after her shift at a Koreatown Ralph's. A few days earlier, she learned that Ralph's parent company, Kroger, was ending the $2 per hour hero pay raise for its hundreds of thousands of workers across the country who expose themselves daily to the threat of COVID-19. I'm not taking away anything from anyone else working an essential job, Mary Kate said, but they just took away our hazard pay. The CEO got a raise last year and the store's always packed. You're telling me they can't afford $2? What's $2 for them? It means a whole lot more to us. Sometimes Mary Kate and her colleagues get comments from customers or they read things online about how grocery workers aren't really heroes deserving the hero pay. We're out here working so scared that we may mess up, you get me? And we go through a lot, she said. Then they just make it seem like, oh, well, you guys have it easy or anyone can do what you do. If that were true, there wouldn't be so many job openings in grocery stores across the country while unemployment records are being shattered each week. But for Mary Kate, being essential has saved her family. She's the only one in her household working at the moment. Her mom, who worked as a nanny and housekeeper, got laid off when the state shelter-in-place orders were announced. Her little sister and brother are too young to work. The pressure to support her family is so strong that Mary Kate said she's more afraid of losing her DACA, which allows her to work legally, than of catching coronavirus. I'm so worried that at any given moment, they will take it away, she said. And it can end at any moment, and they can come for me and take me away from my family. If that feeling sounds an awful lot like the existential fear most people have about getting COVID-19, that's because it is. Gabriela Gonzalez is another DACA holder who works in a small communications firm. She told me that waiting for the end of DACA feels like waiting for her world to be irreparably shaken. The sheer confusion, being upset, feeling of loss, kind of like grieving, that people are going through during the pandemic, Gabriela said. I feel like that's what people who have DACA and just even people who are undocumented in general, that's what we've been going through for so many years. Gabriela said she and the rest of her DACA friends are constantly checking SCOTUS blog, where the Supreme Court typically announces what cases they are hearing or ruling on any given week. Gabriela understands why Mary Kate would say the court's ruling feels more perilous than coronavirus. She has DACA friends who work as nurses, doctors, lawyers. They all get this feeling, Gabriela said. It's like it comes in waves. It feels scary, obviously uncomfortable, and have nervous breakdowns sometimes. I can't really sleep at night, she told me. And I think she was talking about her legal status, but it could have easily been the coronavirus. For people like Gabriela, Mary Kate, the anxiety is almost interchangeable. Everything may evaporate, everything may end. I was honestly too sad to ask Gabriela which it was, but I did ask her how it was possible to work a job like hers with all that on her head. She said it's about 10% hope and 90% faith in God. I go back and remember all those moments where I had my breakdowns, where I cried a lot, where I didn't know where life was taking me, what God had in store for me, and I got through all that, she said. Even now, I'm still here, I'm still okay. And I think being grateful for this moment where I am now, even speaking with you, even having air in my lungs, having this home that I get to live in with my husband, having my dream job, having food in the fridge, those are things that ground me the most. Gabriela and Mary Kate hope that the Supreme Court will let them stay, so that all I have to worry about is the pandemic. I'm Eric Galindo.
And you can read Eric's Mis Angeles column on laist.com. That's LAIST.com. Eric's story that you just heard, Austin Cross's story that you heard earlier in the show, these are the kind of stories we do here at KPCC. They're stories that showcase the pulse and the soul of this city. They're important. They need to be told. And you can make that happen with your contribution. Just go to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org and give if you can. Hollywood is on hold right now, but maybe not for much longer. In fact, the power brokers that be have a reopening script that they've written. We'll hear about the protocols that could stick and which might get cut. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. We've been waiting on Governor Gavin Newsom to unveil the state's guidelines to resume film and TV production. We thought it might happen today, but no. There's been a lot going on, so we understand why we have not heard about that yet. But Hollywood producers and the industry's biggest unions have issued their proposed guidelines. And The Frame's John Horn has been following this. He's here to tell us all about the new protocols. Hello, John.
Hey, A. How's it going?
Good, good. Now, these protocols were released yesterday. Give us the 30,000-foot view of what this 22-page report outlines when it comes to safety measures.
Well, let me step back and say who put it together. So it was a combination of producers, network studios, and then a lot of guild representation. So you had companies like Apple Studios, Amazon, Netflix, studios like Paramount, Sony, Disney, and then a lot of unions, people like accountants, the union for sound mixers, editors, costumers, art directors, plasterers, plumbing and pipe fitters. So it really went deep. And I think it's important to say, too, that talking about Hollywood production right now feels weird, but there are hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work right now.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Tom Cruise or Julia Roberts. We're thinking about caterers for productions, people who run costume shops or do prop rentals. They might drive trucks. They might sweep floors. They might be actors whose side gigs are waiting tables or tending bar, and they can't have those side jobs anymore. So anyway, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work who depend on this industry restarting. So that's the backdrop, and I think it's important to say that. So this 22-page report, which is kind of a working report, first of all, lays out testing and health protocols, that there needs to be what the report calls a COVID compliance officer on any film or TV set. And it has recommendations for things like hand washing, but also goes into how food might be served on a set, how to treat, you know, actors who might be kids, who might not be good about following social distancing or keeping their mask on, how actors and crew members might travel if they have to go to locations, and things like the elimination of live audiences for things like sitcoms. It basically says that isn't coming back anytime soon.
Now, it took a little longer to get these guidelines out than, say, maybe the restaurant industry. Why did it take a little longer for Hollywood to figure this part out?
I think there's so many different moving parts. And if you look at a film set and kind of pre-coronavirus, what a film set looked like then and what it's going to look like going forward, they seem to be totally different creatures. You would go on a film set and there'd be a craft service table with a pile of bagels. People are sorting through them, picking out the ones they want, putting the other ones back down.
All those germs.
There'd be somebody handing out, you know, the call sheet for next day's shoot, and he or she has a messenger bag, and they're handing out paper copies of all of these scripts. Everybody is like drinking coffee. They're sitting next to each other. They're crammed together on a set. So when you start thinking about the logistics of a movie set, it's like a restaurant times 10. That said, there are parts of filmmaking that might come back sooner, Like you could have a virtual writer's room where screenwriters are sharing ideas or you're going over script. You could do virtual location scouting where you're looking at photographs of where you might want to shoot if you leave a studio lot. And there's been a fair amount of post-production, editing, sound design that has been happening during the pandemic. And that might come back sooner than actual physical production. But when you start thinking about what's entailed in the actual shooting of a TV series or a movie, it gets very complicated very quickly.
All those things you described, John, like just 3 or 4 months ago, that's normal Hollywood set life, right? Now, I can't imagine that happening now anymore.
No, and this is where this report gets really strange. The report says, quote, whenever possible, performers shall practice social distancing. So think about that. Are characters not going to have conversations? Are they not going to be sitting down at a meal? Will there be families? Will there be romance? And the report goes on to say certain activities such as fight scenes or intimate scenes increase the risk of transmission. So maybe that's a good thing. Maybe there won't be any more Jason Statham movies for the time being. But well, then it says, like, where actors are together, those scenes either have to be rewritten or shot with digital effects. So you might have two performers who look like they're in the same scene together, but actually they weren't even working on the same day.
John, I'm a big fan of mobster movies, gangster movies. One of my favorite parts, and it typically happens in a lot of these movies, is that the boss is sitting at a restaurant table and then one of his henchmen comes up behind him and whispers something in his ear and they make a movement and then someone dies, right? I mean, that's how a mob movie happens.
So yeah, but here's how it's going to happen now. The mob boss is on a Zoom call. He has just gotten Postmates to deliver his pasta. They've dropped it off at the door so he doesn't have to talk or meet with a guy. He brings his pasta in, sprays down his utensils with some disinfectant, and then he has the meeting, and then somebody makes a virtual threat in the chat function of Zoom. That sounds like a good movie, right?
Maybe.
Okay. What else are you going to do?
I'm going to make him an offer on Zoom that he can't refuse, right? Yeah, that's how that's going to work. We're talking to John Horn about Hollywood's possible protocols when all of this is over and they get back to filming. Just thinking about what you already laid out, that's Hollywood. That's another Hollywood. That's another planet, John, in terms of Hollywood. I can't imagine now how a movie or a TV show gets even done quickly with all of these possible protocols.
But how do you even put together a cast? So let's talk about casting. Think about auditions. One of the things that casting directors and filmmakers are always looking for is chemistry between two actors.
There you go.
And that's why at the last stage of most audition processes, you have the two potential leads coming together and they might do a scene together, they might just chat, and the casting director and the filmmaker are looking to say, do these people hit it off? Do you believe them? Now, let's just say that that is happening virtually, that they are video auditions. They're not even in the same room. And then you get them on set and they just are like oil and water.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Or what are you going to do if you have a crowd scene? So I think one of the things that people are going to start thinking about is like, what kinds of movies can get made? Is it going to be movies where there's a few characters who aren't in close proximity to each other? I mean, I don't even know what that movie is going to be, but those are going to be real considerations going forward.
And not that I need to see love scenes, John, but you know, it's not in a romantic comedy or something like that. It's nice to finally get to that moment, right?
Yeah, you're not going to get to that moment. No. If you're having socially distanced actors, unless maybe they're already married, how would you shoot that? And if you're shooting it, as the report suggests, by using some sort of digital effect, that is going to be very creepy. If you're going to have a romance or sex scene where the actors aren't even together, but there's some sort of digital composite, we're entering a very strange new world there. But I don't know how those scenes are going to happen. And when Governor Newsom was fielding some industry input, he was talking with an actor. An actor said, his name is John Huertas, and he said, we can't wear masks. Everybody on the set can. Camera operator can, the script supervisor can, you know, the grips and lighting people, but we can't wear masks, so what are we supposed to do? And then start thinking about the people who are working in close proximity to the actors, somebody doing makeup, hair. They are really close
right
to those
there.
People,
yeah.
And how are they going to be safe?
Wow. Okay, so I know there's production underway in like Sweden, Iceland, South Korea, and that's where where Netflix is filming. Any foreseeable problems with not having blanket protocols across the world and even the country?
No, it's a huge problem. In fact, Britain just came out with some guidelines that it has proposed for TV and film production there. But if you have different standards, say, in Sweden, and different standards in Britain, and different standards in California, and different standards in Georgia, what is going to happen? I mean, because if you are a producer, and let's say you've got a $10 million movie, you could go shoot in Bulgaria and save $2 million where they don't have big safety protocols, or stay in town and wait and comply with all those protocols, and it's going to cost you an extra couple million. What are you going to do? And the actors may not want to travel, but they have to get back to work. It's going to be a huge problem. There has to be, and I think this is something the industry has said, there has to be uniform guidelines for what this future is going to look like. And the real problem right now is LA County still has more than 1,000 new coronavirus cases every day. Governor Newsom says the state's doing pretty well, LA County not so much. So even if Hollywood wants to get back into production, the county itself may not be ready for it.
Yikes. Now, John, you've been working on a podcast about the industry. Tell us more about that, and what's the focus?
Well, it's a lot about these issues. Like, what is the new reality going to look like? And a lot of it is the practical realities of, like, how do you have social distancing on set? And maybe how do you release a movie? We talked with Judd Apatow, who made a movie called The King of Staten Island with Pete Davidson. It's supposed to come out in theaters. It's now going to come out straight to video on demand. You know, so there's new opportunities for filmmakers and studios to reach audiences in a different way. We talked with Glenn Close, who has had pneumonia in the past, and she said, I don't want to work until there's a vaccine. And you know from the guests that you've talked to, maybe that's a year off. Maybe it's a year and a half off. There's so many different issues that are facing these people in terms of practicalities of how do you make and how you release content. And then there's like the stories that you want to tell. Have their priority shifted? Do they feel that there's a new emphasis on stories that matter? Are the kinds of stories that they want to tell changed now that we're living in a new world? And just think about what's happened in the past week. How is all this going to affect the mindset of producers and filmmakers? So there's all, it's unfortunately a lot is unknown, but I think people are starting to really wrestle with what they want to do, what stories they want to tell, and I guess most important, how they're going to tell those stories.
It's very difficult to have the chemistry we have, John Horn, when we're not sitting in the same...
It should be said we are about 10, 15 feet apart. We're surrounded by a series of double-glazed windows. We're not meeting, but I can almost wave to you if I could wave through
a solid wall. I feel your presence in this room. It's like I'm looking right at you. John Horn is host of KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. He's been writing about the new guidelines to resume production here in California. John, thanks a lot.
I'll come back anytime.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.